listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Good Wife by Julia Ayoffe. Grozev tried to be optimistic and argued that maybe the Kremlin wouldn't arrest him, but Navalnaya saw it clearly. She said, "I think there is no chance that they will let him out. He will be in jail for a long time," Grozev recalls. You must understand how shocking this conversation was. She's this wide-eyed, earnest, honest person. She says these things like they're the most obvious things on earth. But she's saying very non-obvious things. You have to process what she says before you realize that it's obvious only in a certain universe. That universe was the imagined future in which Russia is free and happy. For all her fierce pragmatism, Navalnaya believed it fully. It would be impossible to survive if she didn't. By January, everyone had moved to Freiburg, and Dasha arrived to spend some time with her parents before they went back to Moscow. Navalny's team was wrapping up an investigation into a Baroque billion-dollar palace that Putin owned on the Black Sea, to be published when Navalny was inevitably arrested. On January 14th, Grozev hosted a farewell dinner for his team and Navalny's. He made pasta and served local wine and gin made from juniper picked in the nearby forest. Several nights earlier, Grozev and Navalny had called Konstantin Kudryashev, the chief FSB hitman, and in a 45-minute conversation in which Navalny pretended to be one of Kudryashev's superiors, coaxed him into explaining exactly how he had tried to poison Navalny. Amazed by their luck, they listened to the call again, this time with Navalnaya in the room. That evening, as they sipped their wine and gin, Grozev offered a hypothetical. If you could go back in time and make Kudryashev disappear so that he couldn't live to poison Navalny, would you? Each person around the table said yes, until it was Navalnaya's turn to respond. No, she said. Grozev was stunned. Just behind her back was the investigator's corkboard with pictures of her husband's would-be assassins. Why? Grozev asked. I'm a Christian, she answered. I would never harm a person. The next day, Yulia and Alexei took a train to Berlin, and from there, on January 17th, they departed for Moscow. Russian police were waiting at passport control. He quickly kissed his wife, who turned to fish her passport from her purse, as if her husband being led away by police were the most natural thing in the world. When Navalny arrived in Moscow, Western observers couldn't help but compare his journey to that of Vladimir Lenin, who after a long exile arrived at Petrograd's Finland station in April 1917. The parallel seemed obvious enough. Two men, no matter how different ideologically, who had tried to overthrow a corrupt Russian autocrat. It was an imperfect comparison, but there was one overlap that most failed to notice. Their wives. If Navalnaya is, as some have dubbed her, the first lady of the opposition, Nadezhda Krupskaya, Lenin's wife, was the first lady of the Russian Revolution. Like her husband, Krupskaya endured the hardships and prison sentences that came with opposing an oppressive regime, and like Navalnaya, she had her own cult following among the young people who took up her husband's cause. The idea of a revolutionary first lady began and ended with Krupskaya. For the next century, Russia's first wives were of a far more traditional mold. Joseph Stalin constantly tried to keep his wife from working, and after a tempestuous marriage, she died by suicide in 1932. Stalin never remarried. Whatever pleasures Stalin occasionally took, wrote historian Stephen Kotkin, he was married to Soviet state power. After the 1964 ouster of Nikita Khrushchev, who brought his wife on foreign trips to humanize Soviet power, the wives of Soviet leaders disappeared entirely from public view. People knew that Leonid Brezhnev was married and had children, but that was the extent of their knowledge. They did not know that Victoria Brezhneva and her children accumulated tremendous wealth at the state's expense. All while average Soviets endured increasingly frequent deficits of basic goods. Nor did they know that Brezhnev and all his lieutenants kept small harems in diamonds, furs, and large apartments. People only discovered that Brezhnev's successor, Yuri Andropov, had a wife when she appeared at his state funeral in 1984. Vladimir Putin came of age and into the KGB during the Brezhnev era, and the militant secrecy in which he swaddles his family is a clear echo of that time. Even before he announced his divorce from Lyudmila in 2013, Putin was essentially alone on the throne. Lyudmila was rarely seen in public, except on the few occasions she was trotted out to stand near him, blinking slowly. As she disappeared from view, rumors spread that Putin had packed her off to a convent. Other rumors had it that Putin had taken up with Alina Kabayeva, a former Olympic gymnast who was 3 decades his junior and with whom he'd supposedly had several children. In 2008, the newspaper that published those rumors was forced to shut down. That year, a reporter asked Putin about Kabayeva at a joint press conference with his friend Silvio Berlusconi, then the Prime Minister of Italy. "In what you said, there is not one word of truth," Putin shot back. "I have always reacted negatively to those who, with their snotty noses and erotic fantasies, prowl into others' lives." Knowing how ferociously his friend guarded his personal life, Berlusconi made his hands into pistols and playfully fired them at the offending reporter. In 2015, a number of publications reported that one of Putin's 2 daughters, who went by the name Ekaterina Tikhonova, oversaw a $2 billion fund bankrolled by some of her father's closest associates. It was the first time that anyone had seen what one of Putin's daughters looked like as an adult, or learned her name. The Kremlin immediately denied the reports and punished the one Russian publication that printed the story. In the fall of 2020, the Kremlin offered more awkward denials when Prekt, an independent online outlet, revealed the alleged existence of another daughter, one who looked uncannily like Putin, from a decades-old affair with a former cleaning lady who became a shareholder in the giant Rossiya Bank. When asked about Tikhonova at a 2015 press conference, Putin said, "I've read about Ekaterina Tikhonova and my other supposed relatives on the Internet." Then he grew angry. "I never discuss questions regarding my family. I've never spoken about where specifically my daughters work and what they do and don't plan to because of many different considerations, including security." True to his KGB training, Putin saw his family as a potential pressure point, a weakness that could be exploited rather than a point of pride. In 2019, when asked about them again, he referred to his daughters as one woman and the second woman. Navalny pounced. "The comment," he said, "shows that we'll never hear even a single word of truth from these people because they lie, even when you would think it's too embarrassing to lie, because they're essentially disowning their own children." It was a deliberate point of contrast. Unlike Putin, Navalny was transparent about his family. Everyone knew what they looked like because Navalny constantly posted pictures of them on his Instagram and took evident pride in his children. Everywhere Navalny went, Navalnaya was there, holding his hand or intimately whispering in his ear. She was with him at every social event, at every protest. When Navalny ran for mayor of Moscow and Navalnaya gave a speech at the rally 2 days before the vote, she made a point of comparing her family to Putin's. "I came out here to say that if those in power see families as a weakness, they are mistaken," she declared. "Family is the strength of any normal person, especially any real politician." Navalny's strategy is to be the opposite of Putin in everything, including this. If Putin is an autocrat who is married to Russia and lives far above his subjects, Navalny positions himself as a man like any other. He wants to show Russians that he has earthly attachments, that it is these familial bonds that make him want to change Russia for the better. Navalny decided that he would show Yulia, says Parkomenko. It was all done with the understanding that this was being done for public consumption. And she is the cinematographic, nearly perfect woman who embodies total support and agreement and solidarity with what he's doing. Some, like Albats, think that it's not just Navalny and his supporters who notice the contrast. "I think Putin really envies Alexei," says Albats. "No woman ever loved you like this without money. He's tall, and you're tiny. He's handsome, you're a mouse, and a woman like this loves him." It is also an approach very clearly modeled on the West, where a spouse is a key component of a political leader's image. They violate the tradition of what the family of a Russian politician is supposed to be. People who are worried about what they're wearing, what car they're in, how many bodyguards they have, says filmmaker Vera Krishikaya, who is friendly with them. Politics in Russia is about money. It's a business. By putting Navalnaya and their marriage on display, Navalny has made his brand not about money and power, but about honesty, as well as optimism, love, and courage. Recently, he turned the old opposition slogan, "Russia will be free," into something less abstract. "Russia will be happy." For a certain segment of the population, this is a powerful message, especially amid an accelerating and brutal state crackdown. Navalnaya's image, says Krishkezgaya, is that of a woman who conquered fear. Parkomenko believes that the familial contrast is indicative of a much deeper philosophical divide. "Putin is an absolutely Soviet ruler," he explained. "He sees politics as an inherently male thing, which is very convenient for a totalitarian regime, and that's the root difference between totalitarian and democratic politics. For democratic leaders, it's very important for people to see the human in them. Soviet leaders are scared for people to see the human in them," he said. "That's the difference." Shortly before the pandemic ground Europe to a halt, the Navalnys flew to Paris to see Guriev and his wife. There were certain questions that were just too sensitive to discuss remotely. The two couples retreated to the Guriev's vacation home on the northern French coast. They visited the local bakery and took walks by the cliffs under the gray winter drizzle. "Alexei and Yulia both understood very well what awaited them," Guriev told me. "They didn't expect that he would be poisoned, but they understood that there's a risk that Alexei could be killed. They've always understood that risk, and understood it well." Guriev told me about the time in 2012 that he invited Alexei, then early in his career as an opposition leader, to speak to his students at Moscow's new economic school. A year later, he would be forced to flee Russia for working on Navalny's mayoral campaign. One of the students asked Navalny a question he was starting to get all the time. Why hadn't he been killed yet? Unfazed, Navalny replied that he didn't know, but he was hoping to spread the word to young people so that they could continue his work if the worst ever happened. The discussion moved on, but as Gureyev looked out into the audience, he saw Navalnaya sitting in the front row. She was crying. "It is absolutely not theoretical for them," he told me. "They've been thinking about this for many years." The possibility of a lengthy prison sentence was also not theoretical. Contingency plans were put in place for what FBK and the network of election offices would do when Navalny was jailed or incapacitated. This spring, as the Kremlin moved to have FBK labeled as an extremist organization, Navalny's lieutenants disbanded their field offices, citing the danger to their volunteers. In June, a Moscow court made the designation official. Navalnaya, who is not formally involved with FBK and is careful to maintain a clear distinction between herself and the fund's work, also had her contingency plan. Boris Zemin, the exiled Russian businessman who is Navalny's benefactor, saw the couple in Germany shortly before their January return and told me that Navalnaya was as stoic as ever. "You couldn't see that she was nervous," he said. "She always creates the impression of a very calm person. I think she has strong emotions, but she's not given to showing them. In part, this is the product of experience. In the last decade, as Navalny emerged as an opposition leader, he was arrested at every protest he attended and given short sentences, ranging from 2 weeks to 1 month. Once he was arrested just as he was being released from jail right at the prison gates. Another time, he went out to buy Navalnaya flowers for her birthday, only to be picked up in the street and slapped with a month-long jail sentence. In 2014, he was put under a year-long house arrest. This has given Navalnaya good training in the art of packing prison bags, bundles of food, clothing, and toiletries to pass to her frequently jailed husband. A lot of people don't understand. They only see the glamorous side, says Albatz. But there's this everyday life where you have to maintain a household on not a lot of money and make sure the kids do their homework. Receptions and articles, that's Alexei. Her routine is packing bags for jail. It's the dirty work of being in opposition politics. Navalnaya was intent on doing what she had always done, being a wife to Navalny and a mother to her children. This became harder after Navalny was sentenced on February 2nd to 2 years and 8 months in prison. He was transferred to a notoriously brutal penal colony in Vladimir Oblast, 125 miles east of Moscow. Dasha went back to Stanford, 10 time zones away, and Zakhar remained at his boarding school in Germany. Suddenly, everyone for whom Navalnaya was responsible was no longer under her roof, and the tension occasionally spilled out into the open. Navalnaya created a stir when she went to Germany a week after her husband's sentencing, but because she hadn't advertised that her son now lived abroad, no one knew why she was going to Germany. Was she attending a secret meeting with Angela Merkel? Was she fleeing the country? When she again traveled to Germany just days before Navalny declared a hunger strike, Kremlin social media channels lit up with conspiracy theories and accusations. How could she abandon her husband at such a critical time? But the answer was much simpler and more poignant. Zakhar, alone in a foreign country, his father in jail, was turning 13. In the meantime, Navalnaya continues packing bags of food for her husband. In March, she posted a photo of the ramen noodles and instant soups she was sending to Navalny, asking people for their recommendations. This too turned into a trend, and a popular food blogger devoted an entire episode to the best dehydrated soups on the market. She consults doctors about her husband's faltering health. She continues writing him letters and visiting him in prison when she can, and calling them dates on Instagram. She goes to court hearings as the Kremlin continues opening new criminal cases against Navalny. Recently, he appeared by video link at an appeal hearing, gaunt after a 24-day hunger strike. "Yuliashka," he said, using the diminutive of her name, "if you can hear me, stand up. Let me get a look at you." She stood. "I am awfully happy to see you," he beamed. And she continues swatting away calls to become a politician in her husband's stead, just as she did in 2013, when for a brief and horrible moment it seemed that he was going to jail for 5 years. That time, thousands of Muscovites flooded the streets, demanding his release, and the Kremlin complied. This time, tens of thousands of people across all of Russia demanded the same, and the Kremlin arrested thousands more. Navalnaya came out with them twice, and twice she was arrested. The third time the authorities refrained. Her husband's supporters surrounded her and began chanting her name, "Yulia, Yulia, Yulia." She held her hands to her chest and bowed, touched, but overwhelmed by their attention. This was not her role. In 2013, shortly before her husband was sentenced, she was asked in an interview if she saw her husband as the next president of Russia and herself as the first lady. "Yes, I can see him as president," she responded. "I don't see myself as a first lady. I see myself as his wife, no matter who he is." The Way We War by Leah Fay Cooper with illustration by John P. Desareau. Capsule Collection, Keanu Reeves, the members of Destiny's Child, Bjork, Gwyneth Paltrow, Outkast, Andre 3000, and Big Boy, and Lil' Kim. Nothing anchors a time and place quite like a memorable red carpet moment, for better and for worse. Do you remember how Destiny's Child used to wear matching outfits that Beyoncé's mom made? Stylist Kate Young cut straight to the heart of the matter. Of course, how could one forget? The custom pieces by Tina Knowles Lawson are among the looks that defined fashion at the turn of the century, a time when the world was privy to Lil' Kim's seashell pasty, an accent on her breast-bearing jumpsuit. Sarah Jessica Parker epitomized Carrie Bradshaw in the instantly iconic John Galliano for Dior newsprint slip dress. Samuel L. Jackson was everywhere with his signature Kangol hats. Mariah Carey bedazzled in her butterfly halter. Jeans were irrationally low-rise, midriffs were often bare, and brands such as Sean John and Baby Fat, born of hip-hop, quickly rose to cultural dominance. Now, two decades after Bjork turned up to the Oscars as a swan, Young, fellow stylist June Ambrose, and Misa Hylton, Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion critic Robin Given, and writer Evan Ross Katz look back on the trends and red carpet moments that defined and reflected an era. In the photos, 1999, Angelina Jolie, Monica and Brandy, Madonna, Jennifer Aniston, Celine Dion, Samuel L. Jackson, Drew Barrymore, Naomi Campbell, and Kate Moss. Dennis Rodman, Lil' Kim, Hillary Clinton, Leonardo DiCaprio, Victoria and David Beckham, TLC and Mariah Carey from 2000. Kelis D'Angelo, Halle Berry, Kimora Lee Simmons, Allen Iverson, Aaliyah, J-Lo, and P. Diddy, along with Aaliyah. From 2001, Sarah Jessica Parker in Sex and the City, Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake, Missy Elliott, Bjork, Cameron Diaz, and Gwen Stefani. Streetwear had long had a flair for the dramatic, but much of the runway fashion that predated 1999 was decidedly minimal. As hip-hop grew in popularity and a small group of designers planted roots in Los Angeles, this started to change. Robin Given, senior critic at large, The Washington Post. The mid-90s had seen a period of minimalism and heroin chic, a reserved and a little bit bleak sensibility. 1999 to 2001 was a much more exuberant, ostentatious time for fashion. It reminds me of what we refer to as ghetto fabulous and the rise of hip-hop in a very upmarket kind of way. Kate Young, stylist and host of Hello Fashion on YouTube. There was a guy named Henry Duarte who was making jeans that were really cool, and Rick Owens used to sell at Maxfield in L.A. then. He made tank tops that were really long. It was cool to wear bootcut jeans with really long tank tops and tiny cardigans. Drew Barrymore, Misha Barton, Cameron Diaz, they all wore those L.A. designers that I, as a New York fashion person, was really excited about. There were girls wearing stuff that we didn't see in New York because it wasn't considered fashion, that I thought was really cool. While musicians often worked with their record label stylist and image consultants, for the most part, actors were still dressing themselves. Young, people didn't really have stylists, so a lot of celebrities were wearing their own clothes. Clearly, just a dress they bought off the rack in Hollywood somewhere. Or if they were a musician, there was a lot of custom from costume designers. June Ambrose, stylist and creative director. Luxury brands knew nothing of us. It seems so normal now that the big fashion houses in Europe have embraced urban and pop culture the way they have. But at the time, the idea of bridging music and fashion was foreign. They didn't have the vision to see that this was an opportunity for them to market and brand. And to touch consumers through using these artists as muses. I had to start with costume designing to get their attention. Given the color and the bedazzlement, the showing off of the midriff and the skin, it was definitely a huge, not just look at me, but look at my success, period. Low-rise jeans, exposed thongs, and handkerchief tops, like the one worn by Jennifer Aniston to the SAG Awards in 1999, became popular trends among teens and young adults. Meanwhile, on the opposite side of the style spectrum, Hillary Clinton was reshaping the style status quo for women in business and politics. Young, Juicy Couture came out with the lowest rise jeans ever. They were way below your hip bone, like way, way, way. And then you would wear a crop top with that. And that thong trend was a Tom Ford for Gucci thing. People started doing it after he showed it. Evan Ross Katz, writer and host of the Shut Up Evan podcast. There's a line from RuPaul's Drag Race where Michelle Visage says, "It's a piece of fabric," and that could be said of the handkerchief top. Young, Galliano at the time was the coolest thing you could possibly wear, and all those Kate Moss metal dresses, all the girls wearing them to the Met Ball, the slip dresses with the buttons and the bias cut, that was as chic as you could possibly be. Given, the whole spectrum of women in politics goes from the 80s, when female senators couldn't even wear pants on the Senate floor, through Hillary Clinton campaigning for the Senate in black pantsuits and running for president in a rainbow wardrobe of pantsuits, all the way to Kamala Harris now, whose daily uniform is basically a dark pantsuit. Hillary Clinton rarely wore trousers as First Lady, so that pink pantsuit was game-changing. To me, it was warrior clothing. On March 21st, 1999, Gwyneth Paltrow arrived at the Oscars in a bubblegum pink ball gown by Ralph Lauren. Celine Dion opted for a white John Galliano tuxedo, worn backward and accessorized with a matching fedora. Given, so much effort and attention and energy goes into those looks. It was really surprising that Paltrow's dress looked like it had been pulled off the rack and not really fit for her. Young, I remember thinking, why didn't they sort out that bust? It just didn't fit, and that really confused me. But looking back on it now, I think it's amazing. It's a great iconic Oscars look. Katz, I would speculate that that dress worn today would receive a lot more criticism because it's not properly steamed, and I think that it would perhaps be perceived as overly simple. I love the amount of chest that it is exposed, and that the straps are so close to the shoulders. And bubblegum pink on a red carpet, it just has a pop to it. Young, I love Celine Dion, but I really hated the backward tux moment. I hate a fedora, so it's really hard for me to get past that. The suit is actually quite chic, but the fedora and sunglasses, it's too much. Katz, Celine Dion is such a certified style icon in 2021, but 20 years ago that wasn't the case. People used to scoff at her craziness, and in 2021 it's celebrated, as it should be. Lil' Kim's Misa Hylton-designed jumpsuit instantly became one of the most recognizable looks of all time when the rapper walked the red carpet at the MTV Video Music Awards on September 9, 1999. Misa Hylton, stylist and designer, Missy Elliott actually gave me the idea for that look. I was hanging out at her house one day and she was like, "You know what? Kim is such a fly bitch. If I was Kim, you know what I would do? I would just have one titty out." So I just made a mental note. The next big event we had was the 1999 MTV Video Music Awards, and that idea Missy gave me was the inspiration for the jumpsuit. I wanted to make it really beautiful and pretty, feminine and flirty and colorful, so I purchased Indian bridal fabric. Ambrose. For me, it was such a liberating moment for women. It was a Gloria Steinem moment. Kim was owning her body and her breast. It made me think of marching in the streets in the 60s, women with their tops off, big signs that said, "We are women, hear us roar." Given. Looking back, it certainly feels like it was a precursor to Rihanna wearing a bedazzled fishnet dress to the CFDA Fashion Awards, and Beyoncé wearing basically a glittery scrim to the Costume Institute Gala. A whole series of A-list women who wore gowns that were a hair's breadth away from them being totally naked. Despite a growing public appetite for all things celebrity, including what stars were wearing, a number of major fashion houses were still reluctant or unwilling to work with them. As a result, Ambrose and Hilton continued to design custom looks for their clients, as did Tina Knowles Lawson for Destiny's Child. Young. Fashion and celebrity were not friends yet. Fashion really held itself apart. It was really snobby back then. Katz. At the time, major fashion houses were not lending to people of color, or to bigger people, and it still exists today. There's a lot of discrimination in terms of how clothes are resourced to celebrities. Ambrose, I didn't have the luxury of calling in a look. Design houses wouldn't even take my calls back then. So what are you supposed to do? You have to figure it out. Katz, Tina Knowles Lawson deserves her flowers. It's worth paying respect to her for saying, I don't have the resources available to me to get what I want, so I, myself, will become a resource for this group. Hilton, by 2000, I had begun to establish relationships with designers because Lil' Kim was the hottest thing out, and everybody wanted a piece of her. We would sit front row at fashion shows. Donatella Versace was flying us to her house on Lake Como. Now, if you go back a few years, it was very difficult. Ambrose, design houses only started to talk to us when they saw the impact we were having on retail, consumers, and pop culture. We didn't have to go back and have a conversation with them, but I thought it was important for inclusivity that we were all speaking together as one. And it was for that reason that I was open to collaborating with designers and working with them. Also, they had superior tailoring and access that we didn't have. Soon, red carpets seemingly usurped the awards shows themselves, with much of the discourse surrounding the events being about fashion. Given, with hindsight being 2020, looking back, you sort of realize that early on, the goal on the red carpet was to find a dress that looked really lovely on you and to not be embarrassed. That was sort of what allowed designers like Armani and Valentino to rise to the occasion, and the question of, who are you wearing, became the thing. Katz, that time was really peak worst-dressed list culture. It was peak Joan Rivers on the red carpet. There was lots of criticizing people, and often women criticizing women. Though it would often be about the clothing, it could easily meander into criticism of bodies. Given, in recent years, there's been this pushback in asking, particularly female actors, about their attire, and the glam cameras that scan the body from head to toe, and how demeaning that is. You look back and realize that it was, in many ways, these very young actresses who were placing their body at the center of the story. But then you could also argue that it was a matter of empowerment, that they could own the red carpet and own their sexuality and physicality. The plunging Versace dress Jennifer Lopez wore to the Grammys on February 23, 2000, garnered so much interest that it inspired the creation of Google Images. While women commanded the bulk of the red carpet attention at the time, men were also taking fashion and personal style seriously. Young, I really liked the way Matt Dillon used to dress. There was a Rat Pack thing going on. Leonardo DiCaprio and Matt were wearing high-waisted trousers, and I thought that was great, and I loved their haircuts. Leo's haircut from the 90s is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Cats, Keanu Reeves in all black is a great example of the fact that there's a blueprint that's existed. Timothée Chalamet is not inventing men caring about how they look on a red carpet. Keanu looked like a capital S star in that look. It's incredibly chic. Ambrose, that was a huge risk because it didn't look like the typical Hollywood movie star black tie moment. He forewent the bow tie for the black tie and then did a black shirt with a suit. Black on black on black on black on black. Given, during that period, the real peacocking for menswear was really coming through the world of music and hip-hop and men of color. Early 2001, Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake wore matching denim ensembles to the American Music Awards on January 8th. A few months later, Bjork had her moment. Young, those Britney and Justin looks were horrific, just so bad. I couldn't believe it. Now I think it's so funny, and I think that's why it stays around, because it's hilarious. I think Posh Spice, Victoria Beckham, clearly had the best PR in the world, because she and David Beckham used to dress alike, too, and you never see those images referenced. Her wedding in July 1999 is what I look at to cheer myself up. It's the best. The crown with the hair poking through, it's amazing. There was so much joy for me in that image. Ambrose, anything that looks like a costume and is outlandish and reckless on the carpet gets tens across the board from me. But I mean, it was Bjork. What did we expect? She was that era's Gaga. Given, it certainly put Marianne Perosky, the designer, into people's brains. It was one of those moments that harkened back to the pre-Giorgio Armani dominance of the red carpet, the predominance of professional stylists, when a lot of celebrities worked on their own. It had the kind of peculiar eccentricity that you tended to see then, but I think it was also the beginning of the realization that the red carpet was not just a place where you could get on the best dressed list, but it was also a place where you could really establish a brand. And it could be seen as a kind of personal advertising. So-called good style was not necessarily the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal was about being memorable. Today, says Ambrose, we're gorging on fashion as opposed to slowly tasting it, one of the many influences of the internet and social media. Both have changed how quickly and often we see runway shows and red carpets and democratized access to fashion. Cats, there were less images being shared, so there was an importance to a red carpet. That's not to say that the importance doesn't exist today, but because there's such a ubiquity of red carpets and paparazzi photos and Instagram photos, we see images all day. Young, I feel like what was popular then is what the young girls wear now. Look at how Hailey Bieber wears crop tops every day. I love the runway fashion of that time, all the minimal clothing. Calvin Klein and Jill Sander were amazing then. I love a slip dress, a slide, no makeup, and thin eyebrows. I think it's chic. Given, when I think about that period, the first thing that comes to mind is the rise of Gucci as this sort of juggernaut of a global brand that changed the fashion business. Young, there was no Instagram or online shopping, so you had to shop where you were. You couldn't buy stuff on the internet that was from Denmark because you liked some girl in Denmark's personal style. Cats, in the fashion history books, I don't know if we're going to be talking much about 2021, COVID aside, the way that we do 1999 to 2001. There was such fearlessness and lack of inhibition, and even though the worst dressed list no longer exists to the extent that they once did, people are fearful of rocking the boat in any kind of way. Here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Patti LaBelle, the godmother of soul and pie connoisseur, talks drag and the thrill of the stage. What's your idea of perfect happiness? Being healthy. Sometimes we don't know that we're not healthy because we're not going to the doctor. Like me, when I first discovered I had diabetes years ago. What is your greatest fear? COVID-19 and how it's affecting everyone. Also, I'm afraid of not knowing when I'll be able to perform in front of people again and enjoy an audience. Which living people do you most admire? President Obama and Michelle Obama. What's your greatest extravagance? Shoes, purses, and drag, and my home. What's the trait you most deplore in others? People who are not kind. What's your favorite journey? To the stage. On what occasion do you lie? To my grandkids, sometimes. I'll lie a little or embellish the truth to make them feel better, or to get them to do things they're supposed to do. Which words or phrase do you most overuse? Last time that I checked. What is your biggest regret? Not seeing my sister on her last day of life, and not making the sandwich she asked me to make. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My mother, my father, and my son Zuri. He is my every love. When and where were you happiest? Having fun with my sisters back in the day. I miss playing cards and fighting over crabs with them every weekend. What talent would you most like to have? I can truly say that I'm blessed with everything that makes me happy. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Being too open and generous to those who don't deserve it. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Giving birth to Zuri. What is your most treasured possession? My shoes and my dog, Mr. Cuddles. If you were to die and come back as a person or a thing, what would it be? A fairy. Where would you like to live? Australia. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty. Tell me the truth, even if it hurts. What is your motto? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish they were all still here, which I know is impossible because we all have to go. But if I could change one thing, we would all be here together. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Patti LaBelle.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.